Welcome to the Walls Do Talk True Crime Podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle, and thank you so much for being here with me tonight. So hopefully you guys listened to part one. So in part one, I left you with our poor, poor victim. Remember, we discovered our victim. He had died in a bus stop, tucked away in the corner. He died a very violent death. We got him to the autopsy and we discovered that he had been stabbed over 50 times. So definitely a very, very violent and tragic death. At the scene, if you remember, key pieces of evidence that were left behind. One, and the main key piece of evidence, was the blood trail. Remember, we had a drip trail of blood left behind by our suspect. It started at our victim and it continued down the block and then around the corner and continued on. First key piece of evidence. Remember, the second key evidence I left you with was that it was a violent attack. So we definitely swapped his hands. We swapped his nails at the autopsy. And third key piece of evidence, which I really didn't go into detail with on the first part, but here I am today telling you guys about it, was his jacket. I remember I described him having this black fleece jacket. And there was multiple stab wounds all over it. So photographing it there at the scene, it was, you know, soaked in blood, definitely stab wounds or stab cuts, tears in the jacket created by a sharp object. When I got the jacket back from the autopsy and I started reviewing my photos, there was a big like, oh shit moment or aha moment, I like to call. Because looking at my photographs, I was able to see a key piece of evidence. When I photographed the guy laying there wearing the jacket, in the upper right-hand corner, you can see a bloody palm print. Now, there at the scene is a black jacket, soaked dark blood. I couldn't see it. But once my photographs were developed and once I looked closely at them, the flash reflected this dark, dark bloody handprint in the upper right corner. So we knew immediately for the lab to go ahead and process that area of the jacket. So we had all our evidence bundled up and ready to be sent off. We had our swabs from the drip trail. We had our swabs from underneath our victim's fingernails. And we had the swabs collected from that jacket, especially that bloody handprint area. So the lab was excellent. Since this was such a violent attack, there wasn't a long, long turnaround time to get the DNA processed. We sent the DNA over to the lab and they had results to us within the week. And that is very fast. For anybody that works out in law enforcement or crime scene investigation on high profile cases, they are able to do a rushed, you know, rushed case. And that's exactly what they did for us, understanding how violent this attack was. And then we did not want this violent individual on the streets. So now let's get into who this individual is. It was the morning time and my sergeant got an alert from the lab saying that they had a hit in the CODIS database. Now the CODIS database is the DNA database. So if you were a violent offender, if you committed a felony, you're a missing person, they're able to collect your DNA and they enter it into this national database and there it sits. So if crimes are committed or we discovered, you know, a dead body or bones, they're able to compare the DNA sample through that database. So we got a hit and it was super exciting. And the DNA came back to a young man. He was in his early 30s. And he had one offense, only one, that put his DNA in that database. So immediately detectives gathered this intel. They did a whole workup on who this individual was. He was a young white male in his early 30s. He did not have any direct connection to the city in which the crime occurred. As they were doing their research, they discovered that he had strong connections to a city about 1 hour away from us. So during that time, they're able to establish who he is, where he's lived, who his family is. They're able to get in touch with family and not directly tell them exactly why they're looking for him or what they're investigating. They create a ruse. They pretend that they're a certain official agency and they need to get in touch with him due to the fact that there was some sort of error or problem with a certain item he was renting. He was renting a certain type of space or storage, you might say. So they needed to get in touch with him immediately to discuss the problems that were occurring. They just needed him to verify some information. So immediately our suspect answers this ruse or adheres to it and comes into our city. And as he arrives at the location, our detectives are there waiting for him. They immediately arrest him. And upon arrest, he doesn't ask any single question of why he's being arrested. What's this about? He just knows that, hi, so-and-so, you are under arrest and we need to bring you back to the station for some questions. They read him his Miranda rights and he agrees to go back to the station. Now, it's been documented many, many times through multiple reports, through multiple detective reports about the suspect, about the fact that he was completely detached, void of any emotion, disassociated during this whole process. And for anyone that's a normal individual, for anybody who feels some sort of emotion, if the police come up on you and surprise you and put you under arrest, you're going to have questions. You're going to, you know, maybe freak out a little bit, ask what the hell's going on, maybe even just be pissed off. But this young man displayed nothing. He was blank. He wasn't under the influence of drugs. He had a mental capacity. He knew and was present. He was able to answer questions like, yes, that's my name. Yes, I'm okay with going to the department. But he didn't once ask, why am I being arrested? What's this about? Where are you taking me? You know, nothing. He was just void. So once they brought him back to the station, that's where they continued more processing. And I wasn't actually the one there that processed him. It was my partner. I think I was on vacation when they made the arrest. And so she was the one that actually showed up at the police department and was there to start the processing. Now, when I say processing, I mean we photograph suspects just like we do victims, but we're there to document who they are. We take their clothing, we look for injuries, all that good stuff. It's all documentation. So I remember talking to her and she said, Gabby, it was the creepiest thing that she's experienced and even felt. When she arrived at the department and went into the small interrogation room where he was located, she was with other officers. They were there present with her. But she said she walked in and it's just guy, just normal looking dude, like unassuming. He was dressed well, young guy, didn't appear homeless or on drugs or anything. And he just sat there and stared. She introduced herself and let him know what she would be doing. And as she's photographing him, he's slowly, you know, taking off his clothes. Not once does he ask again, what's this for? Or what are you doing? He just complies with yes and yes and keeps complying with her requests. Now it comes time to look for injuries on him. As she's taking pictures, she tells him, please hold out your hands. I'd like to see your hands. And remember, when you stab someone multiple times, what did I say in part one? You're more likely going to slip. Your hand is going to slip on that knife and you're going to cut yourself. Or you're going to be holding that person down and stabbing over and over again, and you're going to cut your hand. So as she's looking at the top of his hands and then underneath on the bottom palm side of his hands, she sees that there's this really deep cut, one on the top and one on the bottom. And she noticed that it's already in the stage of healing. It's slightly scabbed. But furthermore, she noticed as she tells him, hold your hands straight out. He really can't extend his finger fully. Like, it's painful. She can see his face kind of grimace and that there's this pain associated. So this whole time he is quiet. He is calm. He doesn't say a word. And as she's asking him, oh, I see you have a cut on your hand. I see that it's painful. What happened? How did that happen? And all of a sudden he just looks up at her and instantly he flips. He says, why don't you be quiet and just do your job? So, whoa. Instantly, detective, stand up, sit him down, let him know that you cannot speak like that. But it went, and I'm probably making it more mellow than it was, but if you're ever face to face with an individual, that you know that has probably just brutally murdered someone, your heart rate is a little high. You feel a little tense. It's a little nerve-wracking. I'm not going to lie. I always say let's treat our victims and our suspects just like normal human beings, which they are, and you treat them with respect. But it is kind of scary being in a small room with a killer. So immediately when he flipped on her, he went from calm to angry and aggressive and told her just to do her fucking job. So immediately she stopped, finished her pictures, swabbed his hands, and she was out of there. At this point, now our suspect is now in jail. So I want to talk a little bit now in depth about who he is. So he's in jail right now. He is pled not guilty, and he's just in holding cell until we move on. And the next step would be prelim or arraignment and then prelim. So a little bit of history about our victim. Once detectives were able to make that arrest, they got in touch with the victim's mother. And she was somewhat forthcoming with information, but I personally felt that she held back a lot. But some insight in who he was. She did open up and state that around his senior year and in leaving to college, so 18 to 19, he started displaying signs of possible, you know, schizophrenia. She said she never sought help for him, but she did notice a change in his mental aptitude, weird behavior. And she associated it with the fact that her grandfather had schizophrenia, so she believed it ran in the family. And so when he started displaying this odd behavior, she definitely took notice of it. She definitely felt that it was some form of schizophrenia, but she never thought, like, let me get help for my son, or let's really address the issue. So at that point, he graduated from high school and he did apply to a four-year college and he made it in. She said he only lasted 1 year due to mental problems. He dropped out at the end of his freshman year. He dropped out of college. At that point, she did say it was due to possible schizophrenia. He was having issues at school. He was having issues with the fellow students. And she said, at that point, my son just kind of became a drifter. She kind of left out a lot of information. She said that he made it all the way up to Alaska. And when he was in Alaska, he drifted around there. And he drifted all the way down the northwest seaboard, the coastline. So we have a lot of states that he has passed through, really with not any solid documentation. Drifters, they don't really have addresses, you know, they just kind of drift without, like, under the radar. And so Alaska, you have Washington, you have all these states in between, you have Oregon. And he spent quite a bit of time. I mean, we're talking about 7 years worth of time in these states until he finally makes his way back to California. So right there, there's some more information that detectives are thinking, holy crap, we have this young kid who definitely is displaying, for all my psychology majors out there, he's definitely lacking emotion. He's intelligent. He knows how to answer questions. He knows what's going on. But when they say that the lights are on inside, but nobody's home, that's exactly what was going on with him. Having the fact that possible schizophrenia, we saw the outburst during the, you know, while he was getting processed. And then we also saw just his total lack of emotion, and he didn't care. He never asked once. Once he was even told, you're being arrested and charged for murder. Nope, didn't care, didn't ask, nothing. Some history on him when he was locked up prior to going to prelim, even he had to be separated. I was told that while he was in there, unprovoked, he would attack other inmates. He would go from calm and collective to all of a sudden crazy and aggressive and just attacking people. So that put more emphasis on the type of character he was and showing the capability, or showing that he was capable of this heinous crime. So we have all that information. He pleads not guilty and he holds his innocence for months on end. Not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. Finally, halfway through the process of getting ready for pretrial, he just stood up one day in court and said, I did it. I plead guilty. I want this to be over with. And that was it. That was the last thing he said. So at that point, we go through the process. The non-guilty verdict has now been, or not verdict, but plea has now been changed to a guilty plea, and they move forward. So he ends up getting charged 28 years to life. I know he had some violent incidents while he was in holding prior to being sentenced to prison. So I'm hoping, because 28 years isn't that long, especially when you're young. I'm hoping he does end up doing a life term because he is very dangerous. Now, why do I think he is a serial killer? Let's go through the facts of the case. Our victim, he really didn't have much of a history in our city as well. In the city he was killed, he didn't have much of a history, and he was homeless. He was documented as living in the streets. But at the time, our department had very minimal contact with him. They weren't familiar with him at all. So it was apparent, due to the nature of the crime scene and in the position he was found, that this was an unprovoked attack. He was asleep. Our victim was sound asleep in the corner of that bus stop, and our suspect, this young man, came up to him while he was sound asleep and began to brutally stab him. So right there, there is no provoking. There's no connection. They're not pissed off at each other. There's nothing. He just flipped a switch and began attacking our victim. Secondly, our victim was actually put into the DNA, or not our victim, excuse me, our suspect was actually put into the DNA database due to an incident that happened a few months earlier. Our suspect was driving along, and he hit an individual on the side of the road. Now, this individual wasn't in a car. This individual was walking along the side of the road, but not just right on the line. He was walking way off the side of the road. He was actually on his morning walk, something that he did all the time. It was in the desert area, and he liked to go out there every morning early to enjoy the beautiful desert scenery, to enjoy the outdoor life. And he would actually collect cans and pick up other trash along the road. He did it as, you know, cans for some money. And he also, just to help out Mother Earth. So he was on the side of the road collecting cans. He was an older gentleman who was dressed in just kind of rugged wear. And like I said, he wasn't just on the side of the road. Like, you don't just accidentally veer just a little too much and hit someone that's walking along the highway. Where he was hit, the person, our suspect, had to intentionally, it seems, drive way off the highway to hit him with his car. I don't think that was an accident. Now, this is my personal opinion, looking at everything as a whole. This was not an accident. This is not your texting and you accidentally veer off the side of the road, or you're distracted in some way and accidentally hit something that's right there off the road. You have to purposely drive all the way off the road and hit your target. And I feel exactly that's what happened. I feel there's a correlation between both victims. I feel that both of our victims were older men, well into their 60s. I feel that both victims appeared to be homeless. Our one guy that got stabbed to death, he was definitely homeless. The other guy, you could mistake him for a homeless person on the side of the road collecting cans, but that wasn't it at all. He had a family, he had a lovely home, he had a home to call home, and he was just out on a morning walk getting his exercise. Both of those incidents being that violent, one being not so violent, the other being very personal and violent, I feel that they're definitely connected. There's a lot of similarities in between them. And just looking at our suspect in a whole, he's young. He's in his early 30s, young white male, and schizophrenia possibly onset at the age of 19, which my psychology majors know that is kind of around the onset for boys, and violent outbursts. But I don't feel that just starts happening at the age of 30. I feel like there has to be a buildup. I don't believe that you stab somebody over 60 times on your first go. I feel like this probably has happened before and we just haven't found it yet. He has traveled to Alaska through Oregon and Washington. Maybe his victims are homeless people. We all know that, unfortunately, homeless people don't have a lot of connections to family and friends, so there's not anybody to report them missing. Maybe he didn't leave behind evidence, but down in my gut, I feel that there are more victims connected to him that we just haven't discovered yet. So he has two victims under his belt. He didn't get a third to officially classify him as a serial killer, but I definitely believe he either is one or has the potential to be one. So I am, you know, super happy that we were able to identify who he was and get him off the streets immediately. I do believe that his mom knows way more than what she's letting on. It was shown that they had a very, very close relationship over the past maybe a few months or a year at least, conversations every day, constantly checking in. She would provide him with money. She did provide him with electronics and clothing. So he wasn't a homeless individual. He was a drifter. He stayed in hotels. He had a car. He had a bike. He had nice clothes. He had a laptop. So he was... he definitely had a connection with his mom. So that is who our suspect is and was. I can't tell you his name or information, but definitely creepy, definitely creepy. And it was a fascinating case. It was probably one of the most violent cases I've worked as far as injuries to our victim goes. I haven't seen that much violence in a long time, which I'm happy about. But definitely a memorable one. I do have a lot of questions that I received from everybody, wanting to know about, and I see Kristen Kenko, Canada. He made it up to Canada. Thank you. Yes, Kristen, he did make it up to Canada. So I know in my gut, working there, working this case, and even speaking with seasoned detectives, we know there are other victims out there. He just didn't leave his DNA behind, or they just didn't find the DNA at the scene that linked him. But it'll be interesting to see what else comes of it. 20 years from now, you never know. You never know. I want to answer some questions that people had. And please feel free to leave me some questions in the chat here. Someone mentioned the dog. And in part one, if you hadn't listened yet, the dog, he was amazing. He was a, bloodhound. That was my first time. I had worked with other kind of cadaver dogs, but that was my first time coming in contact with a bloodhound. And he was absolutely hilarious. Also, when the handler came on scene with him, he looked at us and he said, "I apologize for my dog, but he's scared of dead people." I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, he's terrified of dead people. He hates them, doesn't want to go near them, even though that's his job. He hates it." And it was true. The handler literally had to, like a game of tug and pull, to get the dog to just go over to the body and sniff the body. The dog kept looking away and no, if I don't look at it, it doesn't exist. So that was hilarious. You know, poor bloodhound making these sounds, and he finally goes over to the body reluctantly, puts his head down, gives a few smells, and then walks away. Another thing was when the dog was going through on the scent trail, it just stopped, after I think it was documented like 862 feet, the dog stopped there. And that was it. That's the only information that we had. At the time, detectives felt, well, great. You know, this dog didn't really provide anything for us that we already didn't know. But that's not true. See, when our suspect was finally arrested, when that ruse, when they drew him to come into town, in his pockets was a hotel key. When they finally discovered what key that matched to a hotel, looking back now, the dog sat exactly in the direction of the hotel. The dog literally sat down and pointed to the hotel. Like, that's where your suspect is. I can't go any further, but he did. The dog did an amazing job. We just didn't know it at the time. But the dog essentially did lead us directly to where our suspect was located. He's probably asleep. You know, stabbing someone that many times is a lot of work. So I imagine he was knocked out for the day. But yeah, the dog did a great job. Serial killer, stand by. To all my people that want to investigate cases and research, know that CODIS doesn't connect to Canada, the DNA database, right? So here in the United States, we have a DNA database. You commit a crime, a felony, missing person, unknown DNA profile collected from a crime scene, that goes in the database. But if you commit a crime in Canada or a missing person, or if you contribute your DNA somehow, it is not connected. Canada and the US do not talk when it comes to databases, which is unfortunate. And I didn't know that. Thank you, Kristen, for enlightening me on that. Kristen actually worked that case. She is amazing. She is a forensic scientist, and she does incredible, incredible work. So thank you for that one. They wanted to know, our victim, he was homeless. He was from out of state. He didn't have family in the city where he died. All his family was out of state. So they were notified that way. They were able to notify the family immediately. We had no history on him. He wasn't violent. He wasn't known to the area. He didn't have any connection to our victim whatsoever. Oh, another issue that was brought to my attention, not issue, but a subject that people wanted to talk about. During part two, when I said that there were two witnesses that came forward and both of them described, like, I heard this gut-wrenching cry and screams. It sounded as if someone was being burned alive. Like, it was the worst thing I've ever heard. But yet, they didn't call the police. So the issue with that there, and they blamed it on the fact that there's a lot of homeless people in the area. They're always fighting, or there's people from the bars always making their way through our neighborhood and yelling and doing all that. I understand that, but the thing that I've noticed and that I like to learn myself, and I like to teach my two girls as well, from a young age, and just, we have a gut for a reason, right? And we have a gut instinct for a reason. It's a survival mechanism. It's a survival thing. So when something doesn't sit right with you and you hear that, you hear screams, you hear a cry for help, it's just natural for the human to rationalize it away. We want to think like, oh, that can't be real. Like, someone can't be being burnt alive right now. Someone's not dying, or those cries for help. It's just someone playing around. Like, it's probably not that serious. We always try and rationalize imminent danger, or we always try and rationalize ugly situations or weird situations. But I always want people to have a takeaway from my episodes. Like, if you hear someone screaming, I don't care. Just call the police. And it could just be kids playing. It could just be your neighbor being loud. But it's okay, because the police are going to go there and find out that, hey, it was no big deal. Just kids are playing, or it was a TV, or that loud sound was nothing. But then there are going to be those times where those neighbors are going to say, thank you, God, for calling the police. I needed help, you know. So don't ever rationalize away your gut instinct. It's given to us for a reason. Pay attention to it, listen to it, and don't ever be scared to call the police. It's their job. They want to help people. And if nothing's there, no harm, no foul, no paperwork, we're good. I know some people don't want to get involved, and that's a shame, because I feel like when it comes to looking out for each other and helping one another, it's okay. You don't have to be a nosy neighbor and get involved in everyone's business. But if you hear someone and it sounds like they're being burnt alive, call the police. Stick your head out. Take a look. Just, you know, be aware. Yeah, that's what I said. And homeless people, it's unfortunate. People say, well, why did this happen to this individual? It's unfortunate because homeless people, they don't have the option of going into a secure location and locking the door and resting their head in a safe space for the night. A lot of them are left out in the elements, and that is dangerous. That's just as dangerous as being a prostitute, just as dangerous as being a drug dealer, just as dangerous as being in a gang. Like, you put yourself at risk. So yeah, unfortunately, he was just trying to stay warm, to stay sheltered, and he was not safe. So unfortunately, that did happen to him because he was exposed to the elements. Happens a lot with our homeless population, unfortunately. I'm trying to look at some other questions. I hope you guys all listened to Serial Killer Part 1. People were saying, what if he's out in half the time, right? He got 28 years to life, meaning he was charged with a minimum of 28 years and he can do all the way to a life sentence. I hope that with psychologists, parole hearings, and just his nature in general, I hope that they see that he is a violent offender and a violent predator. And he will unfortunately probably offend within prison and not be let out. And they'll recognize him as not fit or a danger to society and will not be released. That is my hope. because he knew damn well what he was doing. He knew it was wrong. I didn't talk about, he had a jail phone call with his mom. One jail phone call. He pretty much told his mom, don't call me anymore. I fucked up big time. Just forget about me. Return all the things that you bought me, because it was near Christmas time. And so he was very aware that he messed up and that he was going to be going away for a long time, and that, yeah, his mom should have nothing to do with him. So he is well aware of what he did. I don't know if he is a serial killer for sure, but my gut instinct tells me he is. My gut instinct does tell me he is a serial killer, and I'm glad he's away, and I'm glad I got to work this case. It was fascinating. It was definitely interesting. It was one I'll remember forever, and one that I'll definitely continue to teach other crime scene investigators on when it comes to evidence collection, documentation. Thank you guys for joining. I love you guys. To all my crime lovers, thank you for following me on this journey. We're just beginning. So stay tuned for next week. For all your family and friends that didn't make it on the live, tell them to go to thewallsdotalk.com, subscribe, and go ahead and listen in. And if you haven't listened to part one, go on part one. You got to find out how this guy died and what led to the capture of our serial killer.